Hello.
And welcome to Dragons Made Me Do It, one of potentially many podcasts about Anne McCaffrey's Dragon Riders of Pern series, but the only one by us.
I'm Tequila Mockingbird.
And I'm Shay, and I love dolphins. Not in real life, but Pern dolphins.
You gotta clarify, because they're little jerks in real life, aren't they?
Real dolphins are horrible. Pern dolphins are delightful.
I think real dolphins are horrible in a way that makes them delightful, because I enjoy a little horror in my delight. And today we are reading The Dolphin's Bell, which takes place entirely during Dragon's Dawn. That's right, yet another lovely, lovely interquel.
Before we get to the plot summary, we want to flag that we will be once again discussing racism and Orientalism in this story, as we did in Dragon's Dawn, and in particular the text's use of an offensive term for laborers from Asia.
The Dolphin's Bell focuses specifically on the crossing between the southern and northern continents, and on the slapdash flotilla that they cobble together to try and get their supplies very urgently away from landing and the pyroclastic flow that is about to come out of Mount Garbin, and then in a slightly more leisurely fashion, which we'll discuss, from Monago Bay and Paradise River Hold across to the newly founded Fort Hold. We are mostly following Jim Tillich, who is a, I would say, minor character in Dragon's Dawn. He's there.
Yeah.
He's not super important. We definitely know in Dragon's Dawn that this is happening. We see the dolphins start towing all the ships out into the bay as they're leaving landing.
But it also happens in the course of one paragraph.
Yeah, it's not really engaged with, because, of course, Dragon's Dawn is focusing on the other thing that is happening, which is the dragons. First, the tragic death of Marco and Duluth going between accidentally, and then the dragons triumphantly making their first successful and intentional jumps between, and eventually showing up to fight Thread in Fort Hold, which we do hear about at the very end of this short story. And here we are very closely following the fleet, so we see both the logistical struggles of trying to get a bunch of often very inexperienced sailors and dubiously seaworthy craft safely through some pretty choppy waters. And we also get to hang out with the Dolphineers for an extended period of time for the first time, which is really fun because they were named in Dragon's Dawn, but that's kind of it. I don't even know if we get the names of any specific dolphins in Dragon's Dawn, just that they are there.
I don't think we do. I think just that they're also on Pern.
But here we get to spend an extended amount of time with Teresa and with Dart, as well as, of course, Dart's human partner, who is Jim Tillich's romantic partner by the end of the story, although not at the beginning, Theo.
Yeah, this story is fun. I said before we started recording, I would put this about on par with The Smallest Dragon Boy.
Yeah.
In the sense that it is perfectly inoffensive. I liked this one better because it's for adults and just a fun little romp.
I think it solidly comes to the top of the short stories list for me because it has dolphins, who are great, and also the logistics of transport of a large amount of cargo in a crisis situation, which is just incredible. I love logistical challenges and I love crisis response stories. That's part of what I like about Dragon's Dawn so much. I was obsessed with Hatchet when I was in fourth grade, and this is right up there.
Yeah.
I wanted more of that, frankly. I was like, tell me about the logistics of the dolphins rescuing the sunken cargo and getting injured because they have to squeeze into tight spaces and because the shipwrecks are moving around. Give me more of that. Don't cut away from that. Don't give me that in a flashback. No, no, no. But she's withholding.
Yeah. If I were going to offer a criticism of this story, it is, I think the story should not be from Jim Tillich's perspective. I think it should be from Theo's perspective or another Dolphineer's.
Yeah.
Because certainly Tillich has worked with dolphins and they know him, but he's not a Dolphineer. He doesn't go out clinging to his dolphin's dorsal fin, zooming around the ocean, which is the whole point of being a Dolphineer. He's just on land. He likes boats.
No, he's not on land. That's the whole point. He's on the boat.
Sorry, yes. He's just on his boat. His ship. Excuse me. My bad.
He would be so offended.
When it leads him to make some very silly conclusions at the end when Paul Bendon is narrating the first successful dragon fought Threadfall. And he's like, yeah, then afterwards they landed and they immediately demanded numbweed and medical supplies for their dragons before they would even come talk to me. And Tillich is like, haha, yes, that's exactly how I feel about my boat and how Theo feels about her dolphin. I understand how the dragon riders feel about their dragons. And I'm like, that's a little bit insulting, I think, frankly.
Hey, now, he really loves that ship.
I get that you love your boat, but
it's a ship. It's a ship, they. You're going to get kicked off of the ship if you talk like that.
That's fine. I'll just find a dolphin. They'll come rescue me. It'll be great.
And I do suspect that she put Jim Tillick as the point of view character just because he was a character we've heard of.
Mm.
Of all these characters, I think he and Ezra Caroon,
who's only barely there,
are really the only ones who are named characters in Dragon's Dawn.
Yeah.
They're not big characters, but we know that there are dolphineers, but we don't really have any names. And I don't think any of the sailors or even small holders that we meet here are previously known characters.
I didn't recognize any of the names anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. We get some references, I guess, to like Ju Adjai Benden, and obviously Paul Benden makes a cameo appearance. But
yeah, well, and Angola is on the radio, and
right.
Joel Lillian Camp is on the radio, but
mostly this is just a story about some dolphins and some boats. Ships. Both. The rafts get to be boats, and so do the canoes and kayaks.
Well, I don't know.
It does make sense, but I do love this image of, yes, we definitely need a 15-year-old in a kayak to tow this out into the sea. That is the only possible way to solve this problem that we've known about for years.
You know how it is in the space future.
And I get that they didn't know how quickly the volcano was going to go, that this is catching them off guard. That's sort of the point. But I do feel like it feels a lot more hasty and a lot more like an emergency in some ways than the crossing felt in Dragon's Dawn. Maybe just because there it is a finale to the panic of Thread or the crisis of Thread. And here it's the only crisis.
Yeah.
And even frankly, Thread becomes a much less serious crisis in this in a very interesting and weird way.
Yeah, which we should talk about because there's some strange stuff going on there.
Yeah.
Especially re the conclusion and some continuity things.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because in Dragon's Dawn, everyone who makes the crossing goes by air.
Yeah.
So none of this matters to them. But seeing it from Tillich's perspective, or anyone else's perspective in the fake good version of Pern in my head, makes it much more real. And this is the first time that they've really, truly had to confront the fact that they don't have all of the technology that they are used to having, even at landing.
Mm.
This is the first time that everything in the colony fundamentally is dependent on pre-industrial technology.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
I think this story does have a successful and engaging balance of that, too, because we get this sci-fi technology on the medical stuff. Like they have the Jellicast and Hypospray, which I noticed and was like, what? Star Trek shows up. But at the same time, they are very much ships under sail.
Yeah.
The larger ones have engines, but they're trying to conserve power. And we did actually get into a discussion before we started recording about why they are sending so much stuff via ship instead of via air, because we do know that they made sled crossings from the southern to the northern continent. And even in the story, Jim Tillich is like, why aren't they taking more stuff by air? This is annoying. We have all this stuff. And I think it's because they are really low on power packs. A repeated issue at the end of Dragon's Dawn is them saying, hey, we just don't have the power for all of these sleds. That's why they're initially planning to hunker down and not fight Thread during this short story in the new Fort Hold. They're just like, we can't afford that power consumption rate.
Yeah.
And a sailing ship is as wind powered as you get. There's no energy expansion.
Yeah, there's a handful of references to them using fuel, but it sounds like that might be engine fuel and not power pack fuel.
I think that the boats are combustion engines rather than power packs for the sleds.
Yeah, that was my impression also. I also should amend it. Pre-industrial technology, except that the boats are all made of
plastic.
Inorganic plastic.
Yeah.
Or plexiglass, etc.
Except for the deck of the Southern Cross, which is teak that he had specially imported as his personal baggage allowance. So when they do encounter the edge of Threadfall and they all have to go over the side, the dragonettes, the fire lizards do show up and fight Thread above them. And while Jim is treading water, he's like, oh, thank goodness the fire lizards are here because we're all safe. But the deck, the teak wood would have been ruined.
I totally glossed over that.
Well, it's also while he's busy being like, wow, it's so sexy to be treading water in the middle of Threadfall next to Theo.
A lot of things about this story come down to Jim Tillich being like, wow, this is kind of sexy at very weird moments.
The evacuation of Dunkirk is actually so sexy when you think about it. Peak flirtation.
Yeah.
But on the topic of them treading water by the side of the boats, it's so odd that their solution to Threadfall on boats is just, yeah, hop over the side. We have these hats that are plastic, so this thread can't eat them. It slides right off of them. And then we're fine. this is chill, this is cool. And even setting aside the hats, which we will get into, it's just, are they doing this in the ninth pass? Because it would be very McCaffrey to just be like, yeah, they've been doing that all along and we weren't on a fishing boat, so I didn't bother to tell you about it.
I don't think they can be because they're not using plastic.
But what happened to these plastic hats? Did they degrade?
The problem is not the hats, it's the ships, right? If your ship is made of wood.
Ah, it doesn't do you any good. Okay.
Thread will eat through that. Yeah. You'd be treading water next to
nothing.
A bunch of waterlogged nothing. Yeah. So that doesn't bother me. What does bother me about the end of this story is that they're getting to Fort Hold and they're talking about the harbor facility that's there, or the cave, essentially, facility that's there. And basically, there's not going to be enough room for Jim Tillich's ship. And they're like, but there's a big cave on Ista where you can put it. But here's the thing. All of their ships are made of plastic, except for the deck of the Southern Cross, Jim Tillich's ship. They can just leave it floating out there. Nothing's going to happen to it. It literally doesn't matter.
No. That's not good for ships in general. I think it's like that the wind would fuck with the sails and all of that. It's not thread. At least that's the impression that I got. Because people do that anyway, right? They dry dock boats in the winter, and there is no, as far as I know, thread fall in Nantucket.
I don't think they're dry docking. I guess it depends on how big the boats are. Because it seemed to me like they're implying boats that are really big, whereas two people can apparently handle the Southern Cross adequately by themselves.
Well, he says two people and Dart, so I don't think it's actually a two-person ship. I think it's a five-person ship, and they can make it work.
Maybe.
Because they have a dolphin to tow them and shit if they need to.
In any case, I think my point stands. It's the way it's presented, it sounds like the concern is thread.
Yes.
And the concern should not be thread. If the concern is weather, then maybe. But also, go to Ista.
Yeah, it's possible that the concern is that you need to have somewhere that you can safely get onto the ship and get off of the ship. If threadfall strikes suddenly or something like that, you need to be able to get into the cavern and get all the people and the fish undercover quickly. So if you have a bunch of boats just there, that doesn't work. Maybe we could physically fit it, but then you'd be clogging the harbor and we need to be able to get in and out fast and not be worrying about that kind of stuff. I don't know really anything about boats that you can't learn from reading science fiction novels in which spaceships are pretending to be boats. I haven't even read all of the Master and Commander books, so I don't know. But I have this vague sense that you don't just leave boats at anchor for years at a time by themselves, that that's just not good for boats.
I also think that that is true.
So it does feel like maybe the reason she made that choice was that she had already written Rescue Run, and so she knew that she had to contrive some reason for Jim Tillich's boat and a couple of other boats to be in the caverns at Ista for 3 or 4 years at a time without being touched.
Well, yeah, that's probably true. But my point is they wouldn't have to leave a boat for years on end.
Yes.
If they left one of the other boats that's entirely plastic out, then it's a non-issue. People can go fishing in that and come back and be perfectly safe.
Mm-hmm. Well, they do say that thread damages the decks, though, even though they're plastic, right? Because there are thread scores on the decks of the ship.
Maybe.
Well, that is a Rescue Run detail. I think they say, like, yeah, I couldn't get it because it was plastic, but it's scratched up and beat up.
I don't know. I'm not satisfied, but I accept that Anne McCaffrey thought it was a good enough explanation.
Or that it was the explanation that she could fit into this 60-page short story without bogging it down entirely with this concept.
Yes, but I feel like that's a her problem. She built that trap herself and walked right into it, so I have very little sympathy.
It's true. She did build that trap herself.
So the other continuity thing, besides the question of whether Stev Kimmer is telling the truth about seeing a boat and what timeline that implies, was there's a weird reference early on. Someone's being like, oh, I can't believe we're abandoning the southern continent. And Bendon says, no, we're not abandoning the southern continent. We're moving most people north, but the Iron Island settlement is still going to be operational, and Tarvey is still going to be running the mines. And I was like, wait a minute, hold on. I thought Tarvey was building Fort Hold. I thought that was the whole point, that Tarvey was building Fort Hold.
And Tarvey is definitely building Fort Hold. That is for sure. But when I went back and looked at Dragonstone, he's building Fort Hold, I think, in the 8th year after. And the actual crossing is the 9th year. So I think if we want to try and make this work within the logic of the story, right, instead of saying, oops, she just made a mistake.
Yeah.
We have to posit that Tarvey went north with the first team with Ozzy and was doing a lot of stone cutting work, got the basics set up, and then came back back down to Southern to help with evacuation or to keep mining.
Yeah.
And then is back by the point that they're making the crossing. And to be fair, again, they kind of don't know exactly when the crossing is going to be. So they're working on Fort Hold in a steady but not panicked way. And then suddenly it's a last minute scramble of, oh shit, no, Garvin's going up now. It says Drake wants to continue. So do the Gallianis, Logarides and the Seminole, Key Largo and the Iron Island groups. Tarvey's keeping the mines and the smelters going. Now, we do know, and we'll get there, from the Fort of Red Hanrahan that the Logarides and the Gallianis eventually are forced to move north, and they are very unhappy about that. And it seems like it happened not immediately, but pretty quickly. But that does also, to me, shed further question on the rescue run. Is Stev Kimmer lying? Does he really think that everyone else has died? Or is he just bullshitting them? Because I feel like if people were hanging out on the southern continent for a year or so after he claims there was that one last message from Paul Benden about, oh, we're hunkering down, then that's a little dubious.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, he did say, I think, like, oh, I had a few more messages from the settlers out west and Drake, and then that faded out too. So it's possible that just no one bothered to tell him that they were leaving because A, he's an asshole, and B, they didn't maybe know. But I feel like they would have told Honshu, because they know Honshu's still there, and they know that the Fusayuki kids are still there.
Is Stev Kimmer listening?
Right. They might have said, hey guys, we're leaving.
But if no one was paying attention to the message, if his communication system was turned off,
yeah,
if he thinks that everyone has abandoned the colony and gone north, it does not seem implausible to me that he would just be like, okay, well, we're done.
Yeah. And then he doesn't really bother to look for anybody until Ito's dying.
Yeah.
And then he's suddenly like, oh God, they're all gone. I guess they all died. Shit.
It feels to me he is telling the truth that he thinks everyone died. But I think the reason that he thinks everyone died is because it's convenient for him to think that everyone died. And it's not that he went out of his way to be like, is anyone out there? Can anyone hear me?
Mm-hmm.
But he's just like, oh, okay, well, guess they're all gone. And then couple years later, looked around at Landing and there was no one there. And he was like, well, I guess they really did all leave. And then 50 years later, he looked around and didn't see anyone and was like, okay, well, that's it. Too bad.
Yeah. And then presumably once the rescue party shows up, he's not going to deeply interrogate whether he was right. He's just like, no, 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 get me the fuck off of this planet. Let's go.
Yeah.
I think I see that.
That's my read of this. Drake Vanneau is just so unpleasant. I kind of hope he died in his little cave hole by Drake's Lake. Good riddance.
But his wife seemed perfectly pleasant. She has bad taste in men, but so do many people.
That's true. Anyway, speaking of Tarvey, but not really of Tarvey, he's just a useful transition point. We got to talk about the racism and the Orientalism again.
Yes. Yes, indeed. I think we see it in a couple of places. We get the same gentle background radiation of Orientalism in the way that an East Asian female character is shy and retiring and doesn't want to speak up for her accomplishments. We also get in Jim Tillich's random 20th century flirtatious history anecdotes, he includes the evacuation of Dunkirk.
Yeah, of course.
And he includes the boat people. And he's like, I don't even remember why they were, what was going on with that. But they were Asian, I think. You don't remember any of the context behind why people were evacuating in unseaworthy craft?
And yet you remember the Dunkirk crossing.
Okay. Huh. So are you interested in maritime history or are you into maritime history about white people?
Yeah.
To be fair, he remembers they were war victims.
But he can't remember any of the details about the political situation, despite apparently having some familiarity.
I don't remember the historical political situation at the time. It was before Earth was really united by outward bound goals.
Yeah. So Cold War, never heard of it. Dunkirk. We know all about that, and it's sexy.
Also, the Heyerdahl expedition, he definitely remembers that.
Yes.
Which is the Scandinavian dude basically trying to recreate Polynesian craft and sailing around.
Yes, I believe he was Norwegian.
So he remembers, again, the Norwegian guy.
Also, the Norwegian guy with pseudoscientific ideas who successfully proved that Polynesian voyaging craft were seaworthy for long journeys, but
you could have also remembered about the Polynesian people. You don't need to remember the white guy doing Polynesian cosplay. You could just have remembered about the Polynesians.
Especially because we know that one of the locations on the southern continent, the settlers have named Maori Lake. There's also, in their list of craft that are showing up to help with the evacuation, a reference to even the big ceremonial canoe. Okay, is that a waka? Are we talking double-hulled voyaging canoes? Is that what's going on here?
We also do get informed in the short list of ethnic cultures that have retained their cultural traditions, or whatever it is. She's like, oh yeah, it's Chinese, Japanese, Maori, and an Amazonian community.
Amazon Capayan.
So we know that there are Chinese and Japanese colonists. Does this suggest that there are Maori colonists?
And does this suggest that there are Amazonian indigenous colonists?
Which would be great, but she probably killed them all in the first Threadfall with the Tuareg. Let's be real.
Probably, yeah. I strongly suspect that the presence of Maori colonists is directly attributable to the fact that Mazaracum in Ender's Game is half Maori. I don't know that you could prove this necessarily, but it just seems...
I'll accept that into my belief system.
Like it's probably connected.
And there are a couple of ways in which this does feel very early 90s. And I think some of that is, in fact, the Orientalism. I do think that Dragon's Dawn, as we discussed, is very much a product of 1988. And you see a lot of that similar Orientalism in Western media around the 80s and the 90s. We've got this both spike of interest, and you haven't really hit the point yet where I feel like the broader conversation in sci-fi fantasy is engaging with it. White authors aren't really thinking about it yet, but you do have the cyberpunk obsession with a sloppy aesthetic version of Japan.
Yeah, all of the presence of both Chinese and Japanese characters in this, to me, is extremely, yes, it's 1988 to 1993, and we have discovered East Asian capitalism.
And the most prevalent piece of Orientalist racism in this is those conical hats that are designed to slide thread right off of them and into the water, which are very intentionally taken from the woven conical hat style that was popular all over, as far as I know, East and Southeast Asia. And McCaffrey just insists on using the term coolie hats. She puts it in little scare quotes and she lampshades that, oh yeah, that's the historical term and I don't really remember it. And then she just commits hard to that word. And it would be so easy to just not do that.
Yeah. Even if she had not grasped that it is in fact actively offensive, the whole way that it's framed is just weirdly dismissive. And given the association of the term with unfree labor and especially indentured Indian and Chinese laborers in the British Empire, it just seems really tasteless.
Yeah.
And even if the racism were not a problem, it also is just, why did they have this as a cultural reference in the first place? Because Anne McCaffrey had it as a cultural reference, but it doesn't make any sense in world either. It's just a bad choice.
It feels very much like that same, yes, I'm in the space future going to reminisce about the history, specifically about 20th century American history, because that's the history that we're all going to know in thousands of years in the future. To your point, it's sloppy. It just feels like, come on, you can do a little better than that.
And you could do it less racistly, maybe.
Well, we can only hope. The other phrase that I was really just like, oh dear, was when it's first introduced, the actual line is, and Ika came up with an ethnic solution to the problem of preventing the nearly 500 passengers and crew from Threadfall. And it's like,
Yeah, oh my God.
Okay, you really had to make that decision? Okay. And then she calls it a cone hat. Great, stick with that, Anne.
Yeah.
But she can't. She simply can't.
Yeah. It's the same thing that came up in Dragon's Dawn, right? Ethnicity and culture are gone except when they're convenient for her narratively. And coincidentally, the times when they're convenient for her narratively are when she can be weird and racist about Asian people and for Irish people specifically.
Pretty much.
Okay. We talked about Sexy Dunkirk. I don't know that we've really talked enough about Sexy Dunkirk.
Episode notes. Sexy Dunkirk.
Jim Tillich very much does narrate the story of the Dunkirk crossing.
And it's their first conversation. There was a fleet like this once before. So that's his opening move. That's how he starts his flirtation.
Is with the Dunkirk story.
He's like, hey, baby, have you ever heard of the Dunkirk evacuation? And it works. That's the problem. That's really what's so tragic about it.
Okay, side note. The other thing about this is that he has this really detailed knowledge of Dunkirk, but his framing of it is that the Germanics had 300,000 British troops pinned down on the sands of Dunkirk. Who the fuck are the Germanics, Anne?
The Visigoths have come to raid Rome, Faye. and they pin them down at Dunkirk.
Which suggests that, in fact, Jim Tillich's grasp on history is quite bad, and he does eventually have a pad with the real story, and then Theo reads it and is like, your analogy was somewhat flawed.
I do think it's fair, if he's a boat nerd, that he knows the maritime stuff and not the context of it. But then he should know more about the boat stuff that isn't white people boat stuff.
Yes. The other thing that I will say about that scene is I appreciate that Anne McCaffrey is one of the few science fiction writers who knows that a click is a kilometer. Things that drive me absolutely bonkers reading a lot of military sci-fi is people will throw clicks around in ways that this distance does not make sense with the context or the time frame that you're providing for crossing it, or the fact that you can see what's going on at that distance. It just doesn't work.
Maybe the definition of a kilometer has changed in the space future. Have you thought about that?
Maybe, yeah.
They should have to do a weights and measures table at the back of every sci-fi book.
Truly, imagine. Speaking of relationships, we're going to talk about interspecies relationships and the dolphins.
Yes.
First of all, I just have to get this out of the way. Not to be that guy, but Ben, who's a dolphineer, and the dolphin Amadeus, or Ami, at the beginning, they have a vibe. They just do.
Now, no rough stuff.
Yeah, literally. They get in the water to get ready for the evacuation. There was a sudden swirling of water around the dolphineers as the dolphins chose their favorite swimming partners. Despite the crush, Teresa emerged right by Jan Regan, Kibby by Ephraim, Ben got splashed by a well-aimed sweep of Amadeus's right flipper. Cut that out, Ami. This is serious, Ben said. No rough stuff? Amadeus asked, then clicked in surprise. Not today, Ben said, and gave Ami an affectionate scratch between the pectorals to take the sting out of the reprimand. They've just got a vibe. And unfortunately, after the next two pages, they kind of disappear from the story. But it was a nice moment while it lasted. And that's sort of...
Yeah, I think that's my general read on the dolphineers. It's nice while it lasts. They're great.
Yeah. And frankly, that they all kind of have a vibe with the dolphins.
Okay. So explain your logic. Why is this a flirtier vibe than the dragons and the dragon riders? Or is it that there's equality of flirty vibe?
That's exactly it. There's equality of flirty vibe. Ami is flirting with Ben and Ben is acknowledging that this is flirting. Whereas like Ramoth and Lessa are not flirting. That's not the kind of relationship that they have. They're married. As soon as Ramoth impresses, they have been married for 50 years.
Yeah. But also you raise your dragon too.
Yeah.
So they are initially quite dependent upon you and then they grow to a more mature equality with you emotionally. The dolphins choose an adult partner.
Yeah. That's really also what it is.
And the dolphins are also picky, right?
Yeah.
Because when Theo gets injured, Dart is like, I'm not working with Annie. Fuck that. Until Theo gets better enough to be like, Dart, please, we need to rescue Cargo. And Dart's like, okay.
Yeah. The relationship is set up differently. And so on the one hand, it's missing the overwhelming intimacy and the unconditional love aspect, but also it's maybe that's healthier, actually.
And I do enjoy the framing that they come to at the end of this, where Jim Tillich is like, yeah, we're going to be in a romantic relationship, but I understand that Dart is of equal or greater emotional importance to you than I am. That's not going to be a problem for me. And I think that's part of what appeals to Theo about him. She's like, hey, you have your boat, you love your ship. I have my dolphin, I love my dolphin. We are also going to love each other, but nobody has to feel upset about an emotional imbalance, because we do both have something outside of this partnership that is maybe more important to us or that has been there for us first.
Yeah. And I think probably when she says that, she's being a little bit in her head, like, we gotta humor this boat thing. But yeah, that is very much the framing. And it is, I think, part of what makes the dolphins so appealing to me. Obviously, I want a dragon. And Theo also wants a dragon, to be fair.
Yeah.
But I loved Dolphins of Pern growing up. And part of that is because Redis's plot is just mentally 3.0. And because Talion is there. But also, the dolphins are just really fun. And it makes spending your time working with them, even when you have to do gross vet stuff that I don't want to deal with, sound appealing. Because then you get to hang out with the dolphins. And the dolphins are chill. And funny,
yeah,
and intelligent and people in a way that dragons don't often feel like in the series, frankly, with the exception of Moretta and Orlith, and frankly, of Talion and Gadareth, and then of Ruth.
Canth.
And sort of Canth on a good day.
Canth when he's not busy being an emotional support dragon. She really did knock it out of the park with the psychic animal friends.
Yeah.
I don't think it's fair to say she completely originated the concept, but she definitely popularized it in English language media.
She really did.
And it's so good. It really is the wellspring to which you can return pretty much eternally.
Yeah.
And she did, you know, shake it up a little with the dolphins, with the dubiously psychic cheetahs. But it's a good formula. I'm not mad about it.
That would really be the peak.
The peak.
Of Pern psychic animal companions if you could bond with one of the psychic felines instead of having them attempt to eat you.
Sadly, for that, you do have to read David Weber's Honor Harrington books.
Alas.
It is kind of alas. No, well, there are good things about them, but alas.
Anyway, the other thing I wanted to say besides that I love the dolphins is, speaking of other Pern short stories, I think it's interesting to juxtapose this one not with The Smallest Dragon Boy in terms of being good stories, or at least decent stories, but rather with The Girl Who Heard Dragons, because it seemed to, I think, both of us as we were reading it, that this, in the same way, or in a similar way, not exactly the same, that The Girl Who Heard Dragons is a kind of test run for Renegades, where she wrote it and then was like, yeah, okay, I do want to do more exploring this concept. And then she wrote Renegades and it was not good.
But to be fair, The Girl Who Heard Dragons isn't good either.
Yeah, so the question is why she wrote The Girl Who Heard Dragons and was like, yeah, I need to do more with this, instead of being like, oh, okay, well, that's done. But I think this story is also very clearly her having thought a bit about the dolphins between Dragon's Dawn and this. They come up in All the Weirs of Pern. And this story, to me, reads as her sitting down and being like, okay, I'm going to write a dolphin story. And she came out of it being like, yeah, I do want to do more with this. And then wrote Dolphins of Pern. And I think, unlike The Girl Who Heard Dragons and Renegades, it pays off. Because I think Dolphins of Pern is really fun.
Yeah, I definitely think this feels like her feeling out, okay, what is the relationship between a dolphin and a dolphineer? And also laying some groundwork for things that are going to come up later, or plot elements that she can seed in Dolphins of Pern. And I don't know that a lot of it directly pays off in that way.
The one thing that did ping for me is the extremely sudden bad squall that they get caught in, but I don't think it's in the right location. But as we get the narration of in All the Weirs of Pern, that is the first thing that happens in Dolphins of Pern, is that Rhydas and Alemi get caught in an extremely sudden squall and they're rescued by dolphins.
Right.
And that sets the whole plot in motion.
And to be fair, that is a significant part of the plot of this book.
Yeah.
That in severe shipwreck emergencies, dolphins are really good at their job, and their job is to rescue people from shipwrecks. And we do get informed in a sort of, okay, I guess nothing that you've wrote directly contradicted that way, that they've been doing that for 2,500 years just on their own.
Nothing that you wrote directly contradicted that, except things that she goes on to write in especially Dolphins of Pern, actually. But...
Well, look, it's rough out there. They caught doing is hard.
Yeah, but then she goes back and recontradicts herself in Master Harper of Pern. There's a lot going on.
We love that. So it balances out. It equals out to she didn't contradict herself.
Yeah, something like that. Two contradictions makes a continuity. Oh my god, Master Harper of Pern is such a continuity mess. Can't wait.
We'll get there.
We will. We can't stop now.
I also do want to drop a pin in the question of why McCaffrey needs to repeatedly talk about the fact that men have hair that is too long and it needs to be cut shorter. I don't know why this is a preoccupation of hers.
Did that come up about Tillich's head hair, or was it just his body hair that Theo was looking at and was like, it's nice that his chest isn't as hairy as other men's are.
Yeah, and then it comes up at the end where she's like, wow, you really need a haircut. And he's like, why is she talking about this? I'm trying to propose to her. And then in The Ford of Red Hanrahan, Mary is like, oh my gosh, you need a haircut. And Paul is like, wow, Peter really needs a haircut. I don't know what's going on here.
She had haircuts on the brain. Presumably many of these stories were written around the same time.
So she needed a haircut?
Or someone she knew needed a haircut badly.
It's not even the 60s anymore.
I don't know.
Eternal mysteries.
We have to think about the time frame, right? This is the 90s. It's about mullets. Jim Tillich had a mullet and Theo was like,
don't worry, we'll fix that.
We've got to get rid of that.
All right. I think that's about all we have to say on this topic.
Yeah, I do have a recommendation. It is not perhaps the closest recommendation that I've given, but it's also not totally distant. My recommendation is Kim Chang-gyu's short story, Our Banished World, which is in Ready Made Bodhisattva, an anthology of Korean science fiction published by Kaya. It is a story loosely based on the Sewol ferry disaster about a group of high school students who are increasingly conscious of the fact that all of the adults in their lives are acting very strange. Something is clearly going on and they're trying desperately to figure out what it is. And I can't really say too much more without spoiling things, but it is, I thought, an interesting crisis management story.
And there's even a connection to a boat.
And there is even a boat.
I'm so sorry. A ship.
I think if it's a ferry, it's a boat, so.
Well, fuck. What you gonna do?
Thanks for listening to this episode of Dragons Made Me Do It. If you enjoyed it and want to hear more, you can follow us on Tumblr at dmmdipodcast.tumblr.com for updates, or to send us questions or comments, and you can find our archive of episodes along with transcripts, recommendations, funny memes, and more at dmmdipodcast.neocities.org.